But before I get to that, I want to point out something Davide told me yesterday, which is, so I had this deformation, which looked like this. And Davide pointed out it's much better to write it like this. By integration by parts, these are the same. And then, so this deformation just becomes, we're adding varying theta angle to our theory. And actually, Davide and Ed Witten studied something a little similar in here's a paper whose title contains the word Yanis, and I think it must be the only one in the archive.
So is the Z is a real number?
It's a complex number.
Oh, Z is a complex number. So this space can be complex.
Yes.
Okay. But if you bring Lorentz and signature, it's x0 plus x1.
Oh, I see. And you go to real time, it will be real.
It'll be null, yeah.
So you're breaking Lorentz.
Yes. Yeah, and then Euclidean signature, you're completely breaking most symmetry. Okay, so the proof of the statement. Well, one thing I was kind of happy about is that I didn't have to do almost any Feynman diagram calculations. So it all comes from the consistency of the OPE. So, you know, it's very hard to write down. The higher you get in dimension, the harder it is to write down something satisfying the relevant OPE consistency. So some kind of very rigid object. And it just so happens that the OPE we find in four dimensions is encoded entirely by the Yangian, and we're going to use some theorems of Drinfeld and Tomorkin to see this. So we call that the twisted theory we're considering. W, it's topological in the W plane and holomorphic in the Z plane. And then solutions to the equations of motion are going to be holomorphic G bundles. With a connection in the W direction. So the connection is also holomorphic and is therefore flat. And so what we're going to be interested in is we'll consider observables. Observables are operators, whichever you prefer. I think they're synonyms. Points A0 we'll just fix the z direction, just consider observables at some point in the W plane, and the OP in the W direction.
OP of what?
Yes. Let's see. So let's consider for a moment like operators on the product of two disks. So operators are observables on product of two disks. Well, you can define it as some space of functions on fields, ghosts, antifields, anti-ghosts, it has a differential which comes from the EV bracket with the action functional. So these are, I should say, these are classical observables. Is this something that's familiar to people as a starting point? Yeah?
No.
No?
No. Maybe if you add a few more words, it will become at least not something.
Okay, let's see.
Yeah,
you have to say what initials you're using.
Pardon? You have to?
You have to spell out your initials.
Oh, the PV, Battle of Volkovisky. So, well, there's various terms, right? So the... I can write things out more explicitly, I suppose. So, fields, well, we have a component which is a connection in the z, part of a D-bar operator in the z direction, and a component which is a part of it, which is a connection in the W direction. Ghosts this will all be tensored with G. So ghosts are just the usual infinitesimal gauge transformations. Then antifields. So this is just the dual to this. This will be the dual to this piece. And I don't have room for the anti-ghosts, which are just the dual to the ghosts, are omega 0, 1, tensor omega 2, dw. So the way this works is this is ghost number minus 1, 0, with cohomological degree minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. Okay. So when we combine everything, we can just combine this all together in a slick way. And we see that fields in the BV formalism, Battle of Volkovisky formalism, are I'm trying to do the best job of explaining this. And this shift, this bracket one, we indicate the shift so that we put what would have been the degree one part is shifted to be in ghost number zero. Okay, is this making sense to anybody? Yeah.
I think most of us stopped at DSP and refused to go over PD.
Well, it's so natural, though.
It
makes so much more sense.
Maybe simpler than yours.
Exactly, yeah. It's really,
it is.
I'm not saying it was a wise choice.
And okay, so once you write things in this way, we see that the linearized BRST operator is this guy, the action functional is just this churn Simon, let's call this Q.
Sorry, what do you mean by D? You mean D omega or?
Yes. D bar Z plus D omega.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the action, the BV action is just the transimers action. Where alpha is an element over here, which can have you know, mixed degrees. So this is a slick way of writing in the whole structure of that.
Mm-hmm.
The action of the Lie algebra, the ghosts, everything like that is encoded by this formula.
Can you explain what you mean by the shift G1 here?
Yes. So normally when I write down, say, the Durand complex, one forms are in degree 1. But I want one forms to be in degree 0 because they're the fields. So the shift of 1 shifts everything down to have the correct ghost number.
What do you mean by G shifted? You mean G with a Z?
Right, like this. So the notation is the following. Every time I have a cochain complex, our graded vector space, putting a bracket of 1 outside just shifts the degrees of every piece by 1. Does that make sense?
I'm sure it does, but can you make it a bit more explicit or give an example?
Just
in a way, maybe. The shift on what? I'm just confused about
ghost number.
On the
ghost number, yes.
Oh, the whole thing, you put parentheses now. Right. That's also good. It looked like G of 1.
Yes, but
So the ghost number is shifted with respect to the degree of the form? Is that
exactly, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you remind me, this is for the original linear one theory, underformed and untwisted?
No, this is...
Sorry, twisted.
This is already twisted because we've gotten rid of some of the auxiliary fields.
And also already deformed.
Yes, twisted and deformed.
Okay.
Yeah. If we didn't, I don't know if I'll have time to say at the end, if we twist and didn't deform, it has a very similar symbol description. So it's a holomorphic BF theory. Okay, I suppose I didn't expect to have to try and motivate the BV formalism, because I threw this to mathematicians about it. Okay, so this is our action. This is the linearized BRST operator. So as we said, in the BV formalism, what we do is we take functions on this whole space of fields with this guy. So I can explain why this is a reasonable thing to do in a second. It's going to be functions on this whole big thing. with a differential, which is bracketing with this action function. So the linear term in the differential will be what I wrote down here. But there's also a nonlinear term coming from this cubic term in the action functional. So the reason for doing this is this is the following. It's a homological model for functions on the space of solutions to the equations of motion, modulo gauge. Okay, so the ghosts impose gauge invariance. And that the antifields, these two terms, the antifields and the antighosts, give a causal resolution to the equations of motion. Is this a reasonable motivation? No? For example, suppose we did this in quantum mechanics. Then we would literally find, you know, functions on the phase space when we do this whole BV thing. But sometimes, you know, quotient by gauge is really badly behaved and the equations of motion are non-transverse. And this is just a better behaved version of taking gauge invariant functions in the space of equations of motion.
I'm confused about, so you have this BV action that generates, that gives you a Q operator.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the original action, gauge fixed? So what's the relationship between the two actions?
The original action, well, if I just plug in something of ghost number 0 into this guy, I find the original action.
What about the F squared term, the Young-Lee's term?
Yes, well, I've written it here. This is like dz times the Chern-Simons term.
Yeah.
But of course, you can, which is just the same thing as like this.
Yeah, but what about the non-topological part, the F which?
Yes. So what if I'm only describing what happens after we twist? So and after we twist, we can like integrate out some fields, and that part goes away.
Can you say a bit more about this twisting? And you know, for people who are not familiar with what happens, how you can get rid of the.
Yeah, so what happens is before we twist, we have some bigger space of fields, and we have a certain nilpotent supercharge acting on it. And the twisting procedure just means we add to the BRST operator the nilpotent supercharge.
But I guess the question is, which auxiliary fields do you have?
Pardon?
Which auxiliary fields do you add to the usual Young-Mill model? You have some auxiliary fields, right?
No. The way I like to do it, it's not essential to do it this way, is like the original we had. Originally we had an action of this form.
That's a beautiful, right?
What was that? So B is a self-dual 2 form.
So in this form, the action of Q, you can write the action of Q for this form of the action.
Yes.
Can you also write Q bar?
What's
the antichiral Q in this formalism? Or it just becomes unnatural?
I don't know how to do it. But I think the thing to do to write Q bar is to this is equivalent to something where I use the omega 2 minus. And you transform it that way, and then you see what Q bar is.
So in this formalism, you can. This first order formalism is convenient for Q, but it's very inconvenient for Q bar.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, which.
Yeah, so which is why I didn't know that there was actually two superchargers.
It's actually the information mining principle that because they're also two bar. We just don't know.
I just don't know because I can't see it in this formula. Okay, so we have this original thing, but now we're twisting. We wanted to take the too many things are called Q, but this is some supercharge. The Q cohomology of space of operators. And if you think about how Q acts on the space of operators, you find, well, B is an auxiliary field, it can be integrated out. So we're just left with A and C, and parts of A and parts of C just cancel. Also, we had some mass terms to the fermions. So some of the fermions also become auxiliary fields because they're massive.
So you can integrate it out because you modify the action or because you look at certain observables?
We're only going to look at certain observables which don't depend on certain field components. So they don't play any role.
Mm-hmm. But you still have, okay.
But some of them you're ignoring because they're massive?
Yes. Sorry, well, I'm sorry not being very clear because I didn't somehow prepare this part. There's also some psi-psi terms, which means we can get rid of some of the fermions. B is already an auxiliary field, and the remaining fermion cancels with one of the components of A under this Q. So we're just left with three of the components of A. Okay. Okay. So after all of this story, I get to where I should have started from, which is to say we can just write down what are the classical operators in an explicit way. Well,
yes.
There's one more step.
So just to understand, so to go from there to there, you say you just integrate out B and psi, and then you get this action.
There's one more step, which is that you integrate out psi as four components. You integrate out three of the components of psi. You integrate out three of the components of psi and B, and the remaining component cancels with one of the components of A. Under this supersymmetry.
So at the end of the day, what is the basic field then? This is where you have a 0-1 form.
Exactly.
So one component, you're getting the 1-0 form.
We're considering the 1-0 form here.
Okay.
So we're left with these three components, which are 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
So far it's only classical. I'll discuss the quantum. Yeah. So the equations of motion is the usual equations of motion.
So it's a generalization to what happened to usual chain assignments, right?
Yes.
In usual chain assignments, when you had all the goals and anti-goals, etc., there's this miracle that repackage itself just as a chain assignment with a super connection. That simplifies tremendously all perturbations.
Absolutely, yes. You just get, instead of having this guy, we replace this by the Durham complex of a three manifold.
Yeah.
And it simplifies. So for me, that's how I would start with chain assignments theory.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this view of classical field theory developed by Schwartz and Alexandrov, Konsevich, Schwartz, Chabrunovsky, which makes writing down many topological theories are much, much simpler from this homological point of view. What was it?
When you mentioned, so this thing you mentioned, you say it's developed by? What is the idea you're saying?
So Alexandrov, Konsevich, Schwartz, Abramovsky have this really beautiful construction of a whole array of field theories in the BV formalism, just in terms of geometry. You just look at some mapping space between spaces with some geometric structures. Chern-Simons fits in there very naturally, as does like Rozansky-Witten theory, this theory, Poisson sigma model, A model, B model, everything, pretty much every kind of topological thing you can think of. Okay, so after all of this roundabout thing, we find that classical observables, we can identify, well, here we said it was functions in the space of fields with some, where the differential is given by bracketing with the action functional. But there's a little calculation you can do, which is standard in white circles in Chern-Simons theory, that bracketing with this guy is going to be precisely the Chevalier-Allenberg differential. So we find it's the Chevalier-Allenberg, Lie algebra cochains. I love homological algebra, I don't know. Of this DG Lie algebra. And okay, if you don't know what this is, you can just ignore it. And you can say, well, one more step. What's the cohomology of this complex? You know, this is concentrated in degree zero, and this is concentrated in degree zero with just holomorphic functions. So you find it's quasi-isomorphic G tensor holomorphic functions on a disk. Okay, so we could have got there without going through all this BV stuff, and maybe that's what I should have done, is by saying, you know, classical observables, you want them to be functions of the space of equations in motion. So the equations in motion, as we saw, were holomorphic bundles plus a flat connection in the W direction. Now, we're working on like a ball. Every bundle is trivial, and actually every connection is trivial too. But they have symmetries. So you can conclude from this that classical observables should just be functions of the ghosts. So functions of the symmetries of the trivial solution, which is what we have here. These are the gauge symmetries of the trivial bundle. So it's some symmetric functions on a shift of so we've concluded that's what we have here.
Can you maybe explain your circular version of this in this?
Yes. Well, suppose we took observables on. If I took this to be like an annulus, then you get what's functions in the equations of motion. On an annulus, not every bundle is trivial because I have holonomy. So I would find that classical observables come from essentially the invariant polynomials on this group, which includes the Wilson operator. That makes sense? I'm saying something kind of obvious. You know, we know the Wilson operator is a gauge invariant function. I'm saying you can just write it down in a particular basis for gauge invariant functions, which you can compute cohomologically.
So with the statement that there is a Lomorphic bundle to the flat connection, the double direction, is the same as saying there is a del z bar, del w bar, which commute?
Yes. Exactly. Well, I tried to talk about this at the Institute. I think people are more mathematical than they are here in general, at least some people. So I hope some things are making sense. But this was the easy part. So the next thing we want to do, we understand kind of the size of classical observables, and quantum observables will be some deformation. It's the same kind of thing. But we use, we add on a term to the differential, where this is the so-called BV Laplacian. Okay, and so from this point of view in quantum field theory, where you try to, if you view your quantum field theory as fundamentally being some space of operators with the operator product structure, this is where the normalization would come in. So defining this requires normalization, because a priori it's ill-defined.
So it's still semi-classical. On the first order, it is one. You could have had the whole theory, right? Like exponential to
the one. The differential will be the same, but I mean, this is some kind of naive version of what you actually need to do. What turns out is that in practice, I should have said it like this, right? If you want to satisfy master equations, so you start with the classical observable, plus h bar del, and then because the master equation may not hold, you have to add on another term, some kind of counter term, and then term by term in h bar, you have to figure out what these are to hold them up, to satisfy the master equation.
But the first term is really in control of the one-loop effects.
This term?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is another subtlety, is that if you think about how to actually make sense of this, this is a kind of naive definition which ignores difficulties of normalization. Mm. If you think about how to make sense of this, you want to ask that the master, this equation doesn't make any sense. It's infinity. And you want this to hold, you want this to be zero as part of the master equation. So to actually make sense of this, what you have to do is you have to integrate out some high energy modes and then check this equation. But once you integrate out some high energy modes, you get terms in all orders of the loop expansion. So that the actual normalized version of this story does involve things in all orders. Okay, so we want to consider maybe I should mention that the framework I'm trying to, the statement I made last time, it's like it really is a theorem unless I made a mistake. I mean, it's really, I really wanted to be part of math. So there's some framework for quantum field theory which I developed. I have a book in normalization, which explains how to make sense of this BV Laplacian in perturbation theory using normalization theory. And then I'm working on another book with one of my students, Owen William, which explains how to talk about operators and the operator product using this formalism. So we're interested in the operator product. In the W plane. So local operators, we've concluded, yeah. The only difference from this, what I wrote there, is we're making your disk very, very small, so we get local operators rather than operators which are smeared out over a disk. So as a kind of a first guess, we think our theory is topological in the W direction. Therefore, the operator product expansion is going to be independent of the position of the operators. And this implies that it'll have no singularities, we just have a commutative algebra.
Talk about local operators here, do they mean point-like operators?
Pardon?
Operators live at a point?
Yeah, it's actually not really going to make a difference if I, in the W plane, because it's topological.
So here you're including Wilson loops in the discussion?
No, we only get into interesting Wilson loops when we have pi 1. So it's just points or disks. Probably it's easier to use disks than points.
They form a ring?
Pardon?
They form a ring.
Yes, that's just the first guess, but this turns out to be not quite right. If you think about it more carefully, what you find is that, say, the operator product of Q closed, where Q is the BRST, closed things, is independent of position up to Q exact stuff. Here's T. So if we think about what this means, let's consider operators on, say, a disk in the W plane. So if I think up at the quantum level, operators are observables on 0 in the Z plane across a disk in the W plane of radius r. Little picture. This is a this is W2. Disk centered at W2 of radius R2. So I have an observable here and observable here. I can combine them to an observable in this whole disk. The usual OP is just doing this, but then taking these to be very, very close and taking some kind of expansion. But this statement that this product, it depends on the position, but it's independent of the. It's independent of the position of these disks, but only up to homotopy. The way to say this is that there's. I have a map like this, the operator product. But, well, which depends on the position. So that the way to make it depend on the position, but to be independent of the homotopy, is to say I have forms on an annulus here.
The other way around. Independent of the position and dependent on the homotopy.
Let's see. So it depends on the position literally, but up to homotopy it's independent. Right, because it's.
Well, homotopy here means in this chain complex, in not this, in the
yes.
space time.
Yes, exactly. In this chain complex, yes. So the operator.
Where is the chain complex?
So this guy, the BRST operator on these guys, and the RAM differential here. So the RAM differential here tells you about whether it's constant as I move along, as I move the position of these circles. It's not, but it is up to Q exact stuff. So this map is a cochain map. I was hoping that this kind of thing should be familiar to at least some people in some contexts. Because if you consider topological string theory, something very similar, right? No? Maybe I talk to the most mathy physics people. For example. If I take topological string theory, I should expect to have a map from Hilbert space tensor N to the Hilbert space tensor M tensor forms on some moduli space of Riemann surfaces with incoming and outgoing. Things like this. This is some kind of standard formulation that you can see in example of digraphs, nodes, and topological string theory. And this is just the same thing, right? Except we're only considering pairs of paths. So this annulus can be thought of as some moduli space of pairs of paths. Okay, so any other questions? Or? How am I doing for time, by the way?
Time. 10 minutes.
Ah.
Oh, no. You can run over.
No. But... I'm sorry. I think I decided to explain the wrong things today and got a bit stuck. But,
we have another lecture for you.
No. No chance. Okay.
We knew we might take a bit slow rounds.
So this is again all the easy part. Now comes the black box, which is okay. So this kind of structure where you have a product which changes by homotopy as I change the points in the configuration space is known to mathematicians. This structure in math is called an E2 algebra. So, this was discovered in, topologists considered this in the 1960s when they were considering the structure on iterated loop spaces. But what we've argued is that every two-dimensional TFT, the operator product in the two-dimensional TFT has a structure. That'll be the following theorem of Tomarkin. There's an equivalence of categories between, well, a technical word which we don't need, augmented E2 algebras and half algebras. So unfortunately, this is like the black box, which I don't need to explain, and this is what's going to connect us to the Yangian. Wait, I probably do need to explain it, but I don't have a good way to explain it to physicists. It's a bit more complicated. I mean, it's closely related to this. So maybe I can give you some examples of this equivalence. It's called causal duality.
This is a constructive relation, meaning given the issue.
Yes. Exactly.
You can get top.
There's a formula for it in terms of some. So, for example, let me get some understanding of it. So for example, if commutative algebras are E2, so suppose I take an exterior algebra on a vector space, then this becomes Shriek, the symmetric algebra on the dual vector space. And the Hopf algebra structure here is a very simple one. We should think of this as the universal enveloping algebra of an abelian algebra. So another example, cochains on Lie algebra become the universal enveloping algebra of G. So roughly the way this goes is that if G is a Lie bialgebra, then cochains on G is E2. And Lie bialgebras are more or less the same thing as Hopf algebras.
So if you Lie algebra, what is your pure operator then? What is the BST cohomology?
What, pardon?
What is the BST cohomology you use?
Here, oh, this
for Lie algebra.
Lie biology, it's just the same, just the cochains. The usual cochain does a Lie algebra. The co-algebra structure gives you some extra data, which allows you to make it a non-trivial E2 algebra.
Can you be more explicit?
Yes.
You can use the blackboard behind that one.
Oh, is it not? Would it become invisible? I suppose I don't have enough time left to come back here. So, let's see. So, if you have an E2 algebra, has a Poisson bracket on its cohomology of degree -1, which comes from, I take alpha beta is the integral of so remember the product changes by homotopy as I move b. So we're going to use the homotopy of the one form, which I integrate over there. And G is a Lie by algebra, so it's a map G to G tensor G. This dualizes to G star tensor G star to G star and gives a bracket on the generators of cochains on G. Is that better?
Okay. Oh, you mean that the first one was the first example? Okay, so you have a bracket, yeah?
Yeah, and, well, there's a theorem which says, actually, giving this bracket, satisfying a Poisson identity is everything. So the whole structure is just encoded by this bracket.
Can you give you mean this is this theorem you're mentioning here?
And Markin, it's part of this story.
So once you have a bracket, what is the op algebra? Can you give a flavor?
Yes, well, the bracket gives you the leading order, the Hopf algebra.
So the bracket is, the dual bracket is the co-product.
Yes, exactly. So the co-product is the leading order. And then the hard part is that you can quantize to all orders in a canonical way, which...
So there's a canonical
way yes.
to do it?
Yes.
Where does it come from?
It comes from, well, you need to, this is a theorem of Ettinghoff-Kashtan, and to Markin's work was part of another proof of this quantization of Lie by algebras. It comes from a choice of something called a Drinfeld associator. So it's part of this.
Yeah, is it the Drinfeld proof then that there is no obstruction?
Drinfeld didn't prove it in full generality. He conjectured it, and Ettinghoff-Kashtan proved it. But
he proved it for UG, right?
Drinfeld, for special classes of G, Drinfeld proved it.
Mm-hmm.
But for every G, it was proved by Ettinghoff-Kashtan. So in special cases, this, you know, you can construct the whole core product using some kind of Kanishnik Semilogikov monodromy.
Yeah.
So
the G shows you can get a quasi up, then you have to show you can get an up. Is that the hard part?
Maybe I'm misremembering, because I thought there was some abstract way to go from quasi-Hopf to Hopf as well. Maybe he did for finite dimensional guys, and they generalized infinite dimensional, or I don't quite remember the details.
Mm-hmm.
So some combination of Drinfeld, Ettinghoff, Kashtan proved you can always quantize. But yeah, that's kind of a side remark. But what de Markin does is, he shows that quantizing Lie by algebras is the same thing as constructing two-dimensional TFTs. So his proof is essentially, one way to phrase his proof is that he uses Feynman diagrams to construct a two-dimensional TFT and then translates it back into this language to show you can quantize. Oh, I'm out of time, am I?
No, you're not.
Okay. Okay, so great. So now if we accept this black box, I think we're almost done, because we can say, now, this general story about E2 algebras and E2, how they relate to Hopf algebras, tells us that the observables of our field theory, they're an E2 algebra, which quantizes, which deforms this commutative algebra. Implies the causal dual is a Hopf algebra which deforms the universal enveloping algebra of this guy. Now we use another theorem of Drinfeld. There is only one. The Yangian is the unique quantization.
Mm-hmm.
Of this. So, and at some stage, this is the only point Feynman diagrams were used. We need to check at one loop, we have a non-trivial quantization. And we just check this by some simple operator product calculation. non-trivial calculation, therefore non-trivial quantization, and therefore Drinfeld's theorem applies.
So I think I quite lost contact from the original fields to the
circles.
Can I try to translate what you just said in terms of?
Yes.
I mean, if I look at, let's say, the old physicist proof, our proof would do with Jan Simons. With Jan Simons, what you have is that generally the one loop calculation would be you look at a Wilson line like that, mm-hmm. minus a Wilson line like that.
But unfortunately, right? He said that these were not Wilson lines.
Okay. I mean, you're right. You can't think, I didn't include Wilson lines, but you can't think of it this way. Some of the Wilson, I didn't talk about Wilson lines, but you can't think of like
a local.
Yeah, we have a Wilson line, and the way this equivalence works is that Wilson lines become modules for the Hopf algebra. Tensor, the operator product of Wilson lines becomes tensor product of modules. So that's.
So, but is that the Jungian? So the operators make up this Jungian are functions of the anti-ghost.
They're.
But they should be observable for Jan Simons, right?
It
so
is.
So they are just the natural observable for Jan Simons.
What are the local observables of Jan Simons?
The Wilson line.
But no, but these are
the local. Oh.
At the local,
but the local on omega. No, I don't.
So what is this? So there is something value in G, which is bosonic because.
Yes.
So it's the anti-ghost or something.
No, you do the following. See, this is the point I have lots of trouble explaining. This conjugal duality is very strange. So we have the Chern Simons series is what you find. But anyway, let's ignore Chern Simons series for now. This is the local. So we have an operator product in the plane. So what we're going to do is we're going to choose like a vacuum in one direction.
So this was the W plane.
It's a W plane. We're going to choose a vacuum in one direction. Just look at the fields which approach the vacuum at the top and the bottom. Okay? So now the fields which are trivial at that away from infinity, are trivial towards infinity at the top and the bottom. And now the operators that form the Jungian will be functions in these fields. So, and then there's a Hopf algebra structure because we can do a horizontal operator product to get the algebra. But the thing which is not quite so obvious is that there's also a kind of a vertical operator product which goes backwards. That's the coproduct.
I mean, even for understanding what are the operations, I just would like to understand what are the
objects. Yeah, so these are the objects. They're like functions on fields which approach a vacuum at the top and the bottom of the plane.
In particular, which fields? Are we talking about a connection? Are we talking about some of the residual fields that have been added?
No, it's going to be it's just the connection, right? Because
so are these things like F mu, F C C bar, F Z W bar, what are they?
No, no, it's going to be literally the connection because let's just think about the abelian case and then I'll get my clarify stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so then fields are like, you know, the whole thing looks like this. So let's ignore the z direction. So the z direction just contributes this. Mm-hmm. Then we have forms in one direction. That's this direction, and then compactly supported forms in the vertical direction. That's this guy. Because in the vertical direction, our connection was hit zero, top and the bottom, and also our gauge symmetry was hit zero, top and the bottom. So compactly supported H1 is one dimensional. So in the abelian case, fields mod gauge is just fields which satisfy the equation of motion, mod gauge, is just CZ. And what this is, it's really just holonomy, right? We have a connection which is trivial at the bottom, trivial at the top. It's a holonomy in this direction. That's it. I should have said it right at the beginning.
But the observable.
So it's not a point operator you're talking about.
It's no, it's not a point operator.
But the observables, aren't they the natural observables for transimons? The gauge invariant, I mean.
Okay, so in transimons, if you look at the gauge invariant local observables with no boundary conditions, you just find this guy. Cotients and G. So H0 is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But if we do this kind of thing where we ask that they hit a vacuum at the top and the bottom of R3, we can do the same thing. We can take a parallel transport from the bottom to the top. And that gives you certain class of operators, which includes the quantum group. And the operator product of those will be the product in the quantum group.
So we're talking about open holonomies.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, yeah, that's, you know, that's more like you can think about a knot, and then one point on the knot is at infinity. But this is the way we usually do it.
Yes, yeah.
So, and then, you know, that's the same thing. So with some line, you know, in the topological fit theory, you can always open it up. Put it at infinity with the decay feet, I guess. So I can think of, you know, if I think at the restricted class of observables, it usually makes it up, which is mostly these Wilson lines, right? Then I don't know. Then I think there's a physicist translation for what you say there.
Probably.
Which is like, so the natural Wilson line, first of calculation the physicists do is you take this Wilson line minus this Wilson line.
Yes.
And then you find that, you know, let's say in transimons, this is h bar times the Casimir.
Yes,
right?
I've done this calculation
too. Here, h bar is 1 over z. So you find t 1, 2 divided by z. But that's exactly, you know, the R matrix for the yang-yang is 1 plus t 1, 0, z. And then, you know, the completion tells you there's no higher loop correction if you are in, let's say, spin 1 half. And then there's consistency.
That's exactly right. That's, and the consistency tells you the higher loop stuff is uniquely determined.
Yeah.
So that's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can see the Casimir divided by 1 over z. That's just a propagator of the theory. Which I just in transimons, the Casimir is a propagator.
So somehow this duality over there takes data defined on these little disks and combine it into data defined on strips?
Absolutely.
When it means.
Yeah, and there's some algebraic way to do this. You know, you start having a vacuum is like having a homomorphism to the base ring, and then I do some kind of tensor product of C with C over A. Like, I mean, the vacuum is like the trivial number, the vacuum is like the ground field at the top and the bottom, and then we tensor product over A. This is the formula that Morgan wrote down for how this works. Yeah, I think I should stop because I think I've probably lost lots of people. Sorry about that.
No, you can just tell us what we have to learn. Any questions? Let me ask a silly question. These theories, do they have any interesting properties from a physical point of view? Do they have long-range forces, confinement?
I don't know if you think you should ask them either.
Is it known?
Well, I mean, if the formation seems to be, I mean, the original theory still, you know, equal 1 square meters, right?
So not expected to have any.
I mean, it's not that one, but it has confinement at all.
Sorry?
It has confinement.
It has confinement.
Yes.
So do these
but
operators
everything
show them?
All these calculations are independent of lambda QCD.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
So there is mass effect.
So sorry?
You add mass to some of the fields. So
are all the fields massive?
That was unclear for me, but three out of the four fermions are massive.
What was it?
Three out of the four fermion components are massive.
Yes.
Does the transimon terms kind of give a mass term to some of the gauge fields? Can you think of it that way or not?
Mm-hmm. So I don't sure, I wouldn't think of it like that. There's some derivatives in the quadratic term.
This FYG F term don't gap gauge field.
It doesn't that down.
Doesn't gap. Doesn't cause a nice gauge field of mass. Some fields are light, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what can you say about the behavior of these Wilson loops and other operators?
I am not sure I can. Sending is really a perturbation theory. You know?
Sure, sending in perturbation theory.
Yeah.
You can. But everything is calculable now?
Yes.
What about over an H bar?
Yes.
So would it be crazy just to compute the whole series and
no.
try to resum it?
No, in fact.
Right. Well, why not?
Actually, it's often finite.
What?
It's often
finite.
Sometimes.
See, but then with that H bar has nothing to do with the gauge coupling.
No,
not the original zero.
Sure.
But
yes.
It's more like the scale of this kind of janus.
Right.
Yes.
So it takes some structure on some scale, like in the triangle that keeps going around in another direction.
Linearly in time.
In a non-direction.
In a non-direction. So H bar is just the rate.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be some physics.
Right.
Now, these operators are a subset of all operators.
And
if not, what do they prop?
Right.
No.
And they are zero string tension, right? Because they are topological.
Mm-hmm.
So these Wilson lines, I understand they are at fixed Z.
Yeah, but they're topological in there.
So
but,
it means there's no dependence on the area.
But in the Z direction.
Right? But now in the Z direction,
mm-hmm.
there would be confined at all.
And there seems to be a long range. I mean, even if you're trying to ask questions about the infrared, right? Here there is a 1 over Z, so that it's a polar law. It's definitely some
long range force.
Long range force on
okay.
there.
But can you get information about the Wilson line in the Z direction from that?
Z direction. I don't know how to do the Wilson line in Z direction.
Can you relate this to scattering in some way?
Well, it breaks down in symmetry, so I don't know the techniques.
So have some examples been explicitly like that?
Yeah, I mean, because it just connects with the standard. If you take the expectation value of these Wilson operators, there's this whole literature about
mm-hmm.
computing them.
Mm-hmm.
And I take a standard representation of SLI, and then there's just you just write down the OR matrix, and there's
just
this formula.
For
yeah.
So that comes from the integrable
yeah.
literature.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Manchabon is the main result, but the main result is staying quite vague. I don't know whether one can give the example of this main result maybe more specifically. Basically, my understanding is that there's a Wilson in this 4-dimensional space-time, there's some kind of Wilson loops, some n of this direction and wrap around that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And this partition function is related to some kind of integral model.
Oh, it is the...
It is the integral.
It is the partition function of the integral model.
Yeah, but what integral model? So how exactly, say, for example, if you do this for SU2 gauge field.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And which particular integral model?
The XXX model.
XXX.
And what the integral model? In the sense, the model and the chain,
the Russian constructed them.
It's like the product of Tempel-Kassel matrices.
This is how they were initially constructed. So in the 80s, the Russian constructed all these series of integrable models.
Yeah, using the Youngian.
The XXX, and then the Bessons that are constructed from them. So all the ones are labeled by the Bessons.
Something called like how M and N related. I mean, what is integral model? That's a pass integral in the 2D-dimensional space-time.
Oh no,
it's m times n lattice point. Oh.
Exactly, that's exactly right. M times n lattice point
mm-hmm.
on a toroidal doubly periodic lattice.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
it's the XXS model on that lattice.
What is the XXS model? I mean, on each lattice side, what degree of freedom? How
so,
just 2 degrees of freedom?
There's 2 degrees of freedom on, like, it's normally on the links between the lattices, there's 2 degrees of freedom.
Oh, I see.
And there's a particular interaction at the vertex, which is
okay.
given by the OR matrix. There's a formula for it.
I see.
Why GI to JJ? That's two spins.
I see. And so then
yeah,
that's true for all gauge group, or on SU2 for XXX model, for different gauge group have a different model.
Yeah, the Russians developed this whole series of integral models for every representation of the Youngian. And it's that integral model.
Yeah, but for how they relate to your gauge group.
So okay, so for every gauge group and for some subclass of representations,
okay,
there is an integral model. So if I take the gauge group and I put that representation on the Wilson on my Wilson line, I'll get the integral model
mm-hmm.
corresponding to it, which was constructed by the Fadeev school.
It's always pretty much the XXX, right?
Well, let's say for SU2, let's say if you take the spin 1/2 representation, then you have a spin. And then the model is just the Heisenberg model with a nearest neighbor interaction.
But you can have XXX with any spins.
But if you take SLN, then you know you take the fundamental representation, it has an n vector.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's a XXX, you know, it's a specific polynomial of invariant of SLN that takes scalar products that you can show is integrable. So it's for SU2 it's the natural model. For SLN, you know, you have to fix some. I think it's the other n polynomial that has specific
mm-hmm.
coefficients.
But I wonder maybe this question can answer Neil's question. It means that if you know the integral model, then we just do it and to see whether it's a have a long-range correlation, like algebraic, or average short-range, there is a confinement, you know. Probably from this one can get a lot of information about the dynamics of a gauge theory.
I don't understand enough about dynamics of gauge theory to answer that question, but...
But it's the dynamic of the gauge theory in the presence of this null
background.
But if those Wilson lines are far apart, whether there's a, we can tell whether there's a long range interaction between them or not.
That's
one probably can tell.
That's right. This
integral model.
We need the interaction has like 1/z in it. So
yeah,
as they get very far apart, there's a pole at infinity.
Okay.
No, the other way around. 1/z equals to 0.
Sorry.
No, the other way around. It becomes as they go very far apart.
It becomes weaker.
Becomes weaker. Yes.
But it's weaker
as
a
parallel
exponential.
It's parallel.
Oh, parallel.
That's
so it's
gapless.
Yeah. It seems like there are long range.
Yeah. There's a gapless extension around. So it can't see CFT.
Yes, I see.
Can you guess of something we should do XXY or XYZ?
No.
XXZ
is related to the. Quantum affine algebra. So I can kind of see the quantum loop group, which is a quantum affine algebra at level 0, but I don't see how to see the level of the quantum affine algebra up here. There's no two parameters, I can only see one of them.
So I'm surprised that you say there is early perturbative information in H1, because I thought the whole point of quantum groups is that they give non perturbative results in H1. Mm-hmm. Don't they? And people study the coset models or sigma models and know when you can formulate it as a quantum group, then you get non-perturbative information, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it limited?
I'm not sure what to say. I think
maybe it's not really H-bar.
It's not the same H-bar.
It's expanding in the rate of change of this theta angle.
Yeah.
But is it actually non-perturbative in H-bar then? If we think about the usual H-bar?
So
this
is the twist
is
huge.
You think the twist killed the H-coupler concept?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So these are questions which do not depend on lambda QCD, they only depend on the dynamics.
So somehow you identify quantities which are independent of the coupling concept
mm-hmm.
in the gauge theory.
Yeah, and that happens even before you deform. Yeah.
So can you see?
You make the axiom very linear. You can
so okay, but then they are non-perturbative. What is it, true? They're independent of the gauge coupling concept. They must be non-perturbative.
Well, if you understand the infrared dynamic,
right?
If there was an infrared fixed point, you would compute the dynamics of the infrared fixed point. But I'm not sure if there is an infrared fixed point in this deformation.
I mean, it's a scale invariant. The formation of the Lagrange.
Yes.
So clearly there is some large scale dynamics.
Sounds like it's not preserved.
But the uniform theory is in some sense is trivial in the extreme infrared, right? It's
mm-hmm.
you have massive vacuum.
Yeah. But the deformed one.
Yes, so obviously is there an non-trivial CFT in the infrared or not? And then you're computing the properties of the CFT.
Yeah, exactly. without the master series of freedom, right?
Yes.
There cannot be the vision of the world. I mean,
yes.
There can probably kind of three-dimensional division.
So what I'm confused about, you have some background, Peter.
Yes.
But if I just think about the gauge
theory,
the original gauge theory still has propagating degrees of freedom and all kinds of
stuff. But
you are considering very particular observables that are supersymmetric.
Sorry?
You are considering very particular supersymmetric observables.
Mm-hmm.
In any supersymmetric gauge theory, you always have observables that are protected, right?
But not really. Right. So in this particular theory, if you don't deform it, you don't have supersymmetric with some loops.
About the nouns.
That's nice. Which I don't know what actually compute.
Yeah, I mean, the supersymmetric observables are just a component of the curvature, is the only one before you deform.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, maybe
what
you
said
that in this linear.
No, it's just that when Neil says it's just the axion or just this theta angle, that came with these masters. So the deformation.
Yes. Sure.
Did something very brutal to the infrared respect.
Yeah, but they're saying that the gauge fields are not massive. So the fermions are massive.
Maybe some component of the gauge field.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Like,
some
massive.
Of the gauge field would be massive, but
in particular vacuum, I use commit the expectation values. Everything is massive. But I don't know what this vacuum means before it twists me. Just.
Yeah, but I mean, the special function of whistle loops depends.
It certainly depends on the position.
It doesn't go to zero exponentially fast.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So which means that there is something which is mediated.
Light.
Excellent.
Light.
Oh, I think I got confused by the massive. Yes.
Normally this would be killed by non-perturbative effects.
Right, yes.
But this calculation is independent of the Gishtar, so it cannot be killed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So maybe this linearly varying theta angle changes the dynamics in some way.
Well, sometimes when you compute correlators along light cones, you becomes independent of events. It's like a sort of relativistic shockwave. It doesn't care about events. It's the only analogy I can think of.
Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine that some gluon mold gets stuck on this profile.
Gets stuck in this profile, exactly.
That's like you can imagine exactly a shockwave for the axion.
Yeah.
And then outside of the shockwave, I think it would be massive, but on the shockwave, presumably, it's sort of as good as some.
Okay, well, it sounds like there's some interesting work to figure out what this means.
So we can translate it into
physical language.
Yeah.